the sample size, I mean, when you are getting an IRs for this thing, maybe there's no problem with the data.
Yeah, I mean, people use the eBay Max and call it a
unless you want to use forward.
Okay, so I can also use the forward. Okay.
Remind us if you need them that your final project is due a week from today at 5 p.m. Week from today, 5 p.m. Okay. The final exam is 2 weeks from today. And if you want to take the early final, it's going to be May 11th, I think, which is a Thursday. So make sure you go in and sign that Google spreadsheet so I know how many people are taking the early final. So any questions on the dates? One other thing, if you... The to-do list that I sent you Friday, I think, or Thursday, whichever day it was, one of the last items I said was as you start to get the numbers together on your companies, which will happen sometime this week, you know what I mean by the numbers, your DCF value, your pricing, and you come to a recommendation. If you can send me just the summary of what you found, basically, and the spreadsheet I sent, and I'll resend it again just in case you did not see it. Just ask for what's your DCF value, what's your pricing, what's your final recommendation, like 8 items from each company. If you can send them in to me by this Sunday. Now, the reason I need it by Sunday is on Monday, we're actually going to be done with the lecture note pack, and what I'm going to do instead is focus on what you found with your companies. What percentage of you found undervalued, what percent found overvalued, how many buys, how many sells, what is the pricing relative to the value. But to do that, I need your numbers. So your numbers need to get to me by Sunday night at the latest because I need some time to put them together. And if you can get them earlier, even better. So if you get your numbers done on Thursday, don't wait till Sunday to send them to me. Just go ahead and send them. And if you have a group with a holdout, you know what I'm talking about? That one person in your group, you're not even sure they've picked a company yet. They exist in your group. You haven't seen them. You haven't heard from them. Just send in the rest of your numbers because I need as many numbers as I can get. So I'll send that spreadsheet out again after class today. One final point on pricing, and this actually relates to those of you who are trying to price the money-losing companies. If you're trying to price a money-losing company, what's the biggest problem you face? Try to compute price-earnings ratio, it's not going to work. EV to EBITDA might not work. You're either stuck with revenue multiples or you might decide to try something else. There are two things you can try. One is you can stay with the revenue multiple and try to explain it, right? Because that's the only thing you might be able to do. The other is to actually, rather than use today's numbers, which are, might be, if you have a young growing company and a company where things are changing, rather than use today's numbers, you might decide to go out to year 5 or year 10 of your DCF. You have revenues and profits and margins. And actually do your pricing on a forward number. Okay? Louise yesterday sent an email about Tesla, pricing Tesla. And one of the biggest problems is you try to price Tesla with today's numbers, you get some strange-looking pricing because today's numbers, they're losing money, they have this big growth rate. You could actually take Tesla's numbers that you forecast in year 10, plug in those numbers into that regression you got from automobile companies. And you'll have more substance to your company and might be able to come up with a pricing that you can actually use. Okay? So do the best you can. And if the data doesn't cooperate, the data doesn't cooperate. I've been getting emails all week and say, I have a low R-squared, what should I do? I don't know. What are you going to do? You can either increase your sample or throw more variables. And eventually, if your R-squared is low, it might stay low. It might be that in this sector, it's very difficult to explain differences in prices. But here's the bottom line. What's your end mission? To tell me whether to buy or sell the stock, right? It doesn't require you to actually trust a regression. You can run a regression, put numbers in for your company, come up with a number for your company and say, this is a really odd number for my company. And tell me it's an odd number and why you think it's an odd number and say, I'm not going to include this. This is an input into your decision-making. So I'm not going to base my decision on this number. I'm going to base it on something else. And tell me what that something else could be, a DCF. So you remain in control of the process. Nobody is going to force you to buy a company because your regression multiple is 280. So run the regression, come up with a number, and if you don't feel comfortable with that number, then weight it less or not at all in your final decision as to whether to buy or sell the stock. Okay? Any questions? Okay. So now let's turn to today's session. As I said, today we're going to take apart acquisitions and look at why they go wrong so often. And there are 7 sins I'm going to talk about in the context of today. And I'm going to make this as much a test of how much you remember about this class as it is about acquisitions. The first sin is what I'm going to call risk transference, where a safe company acquires a risky company and acts like because it's a safe company, the risky company just became more valuable. Sounds abstract, but I'll give you an example to kind of illustrate. The second is what's called debt subsidization, where a company that is able to borrow money at a really low rate then goes out and does an acquisition and justifies that acquisition because it can borrow money at a really low rate. The third is this control premium, the notion that you can add 20% onto your valuation because it's an acquisition. The fourth is the word synergy. We're going to talk about what synergy is, when it actually matters, how to value it, and why a lot of people don't even seem to try. Fifth, I'm going to talk about how pricing finds its way into acquisitions. Okay? Sixth, I'm going to talk about how in many valuations or many acquisitions, the biggest problem is somebody decides what to do. Then they go looking for an explanation or a justification for what they do. I call this verdict first, trial afterwards. And finally, and this is what drives me crazy about acquisitions. You take a $50 million project and you screw up. You get fired. You do a $50 billion acquisition and you screw up. You get promoted. Don't ask me why it happens, but it seems to be the nature of the process. So ready? I need some engagement today. So as we go through, here's what I want you to do. I'm going to put a series of 7 tests to you. And with each one, I want you, and this is about just being honest with yourself, whether you pass the test or fail the test. At the end of today's class, I want you to list out whether you passed or failed all 7 tests. And if you failed, what your rationale was for why you gave the answer that you did. So let's start the game. Let's suppose you work for the acquiring company. You're looking at a target company. And you don't need a calculator, so much of the stuff we do, you should be able to do it in your head. Here's the target company. The target company has revenues of $100 million, operating income of operating income of $20 million, taxes of $8 million, and after-tax operating income of $12 million. That's what the target company's numbers look like for the most recent year. This company will generate this $12 million operating income forever with no growth. It's an all-equity-funded company. Cost of equity is 12%. What's the value of this target company? Fernando, what is it? What's the value of the target company? $60 million, right? How do you get the $60 million? You take the $12 million, How come I didn't give you a capex and a depreciation or a working capital? Don't you need that to get to cash flows? There's no growth. That's the key. If there's no growth, there's no reinvestment. So I'm discounting the $12 million at the 20%. Why? Because if there's no growth, why do I have to reinvest money? And if I don't reinvest money, the after-tax operating income becomes the cash flow. I discount by the cost of equity because it's all equity funded, $60 million. So everybody comfortable with that? That's your base value for the target company. Now I'm going to turn the game over to you. You're the acquiring company. Let's say that you are a much safer company than me. Your cost of equity is 10%. I just showed you the numbers for the target company. What is the value of the target company to you? What's the question I'm asking you? When you, as the acquiring company, value the target company, which cost of equity are you going to use? Are you going to use your cost of equity? Because after all, you're coming up with the money. Are you going to use the 20% cost of equity, which is the target company, or is it going to be some number in the middle? What did you say? Tell me why. No, that's not the rationale, because then if I flip the numbers, you're going to go with the 10. So if I made the acquiring company 20%, the target company, you can't go with the cheaper argument, because that's a very slippery argument. Why? Right. Remember in capital budgeting in corporate finance, you taught that the discount rate for a project should reflect what? The riskiness of the project, not the riskiness of the... So if I came to you with a guaranteed project, what should you use as your discount rate? Your risk-free rate. It doesn't matter how risky you are as a company. Now do you see why this is just an extension of that concept? A target company is just a gigantic project, and if you're valuing the target company, it should be the cost of equity of the target company you should be using, not the cost of equity of the acquiring company. You know that half of all M&A valuations, you'll see bankers using the acquiring company's cost of capital to value the target company. You're violating one of corporate finance's base principles right off the top. The rationale you give is, hey, it's my money. I raised the money at 10%. Why shouldn't I use it? Tell me why I shouldn't use it. What's going to happen if over time I keep using this 10%? I'm a safe company. I have a really low cost of equity. If I keep valuing target companies that cost of equity, what am I going to find? Every risky company I look at is going to look like an incredible bargain to me, right? I'm going to be willing to pay a premium, not because a company is cheap, but because I am a safe company. This is how AT&T almost drove itself into destruction in the 1990s. Because it brought a low cost of equity and capital to the table and said, hey, we have a low cost of equity. I'm going to attach that to every target company and inflate the value of the company. So if you're an acquiring company, don't go around endowing your beta. So if I gave you a beta for a target company and acquiring company to value the target company, it's only the target company's beta that matters in coming up with the cost of equity and cost of capital for the company. Any questions? Okay. Here's the second test, and this is a tougher one. So let's say I listen to you and say, okay, so everybody passed the test? Act like you did. Just put the 20%. So you passed that. So you pass the risk subsidization, the risk transference test. Let's move to the debt subsidy test. So let's say you convince me that I should use a 20% cost of equity. But let's assume that you as the acquiring company have access to cheap debt, after-tax cost of 4%, and that you plan to fund half of this acquisition with debt. What's the value of the target company now? Let's say the cost of equity stays at 20%. You should unlever and re-lever the beta. But let's say the cost of equity for the target company stays at 20%. But now you're going to borrow half your money at 4% and raise half from equity at 20%. It looks like your cost of capital should be 12%, which if you discount the $12 million at 12% should increase the... That's magical, right? You've just increased the value of the company by $40 million. Why shouldn't you do that? Why is your cost of capital going down? Because you have access to really cheap debt. How did you get that access to really cheap debt? Because you were very careful in the past about how much to borrow. In other words, you built up this really cheap debt for all the stuff. Now what are you doing? You're giving me the benefit of something I had absolutely no role in creating. render unto the target company that which is theirs and not a penny more. I had nothing to do with you having cheap debt. The fact that you can raise money at a AAA rate is great, but why should you be paying me a premium because you can raise money at a AAA rate? I'm not stopping you from borrowing money and doing the acquisition. I'm just saying, don't put that into your valuation because it has nothing to do with me. In fact, I've seen cost of capital calculations for target companies. Because remember, if you're a big acquiring company and you're buying a target company, could you use 100% debt to do the acquisition? Yeah, why not? I've seen people use a cost of capital which is equal to the after-tax cost of debt because they say, look, I took 100%. I'm just following the mechanics. It's 100% debt, 0% equity. My cost of capital is 3.5%. And if I'm the target company stockholders, I'm partying like there's no tomorrow because you've just given me this huge premium and I had absolutely nothing to do with it. So just because you have access to cheap debt doesn't mean the cost of capital magically comes down and the value of the firm goes up. Any questions on that? So the basic rule here is make sure that when you're putting in a debt ratio, a cost of debt for the target company, it reflects a debt ratio, a cost of debt that the target company would have been able to borrow on its own, not something that you're able to do because you're GE and buying a small company. Third, let's talk about control premiums. The typical control premium, and you see this used in many M&A play. If you go into bank, work in M&A in a bank, you're told to do a discounted cash flow valuation, then to add a 20% premium on to that value for control. It's standard. Right? It's actually one of the most common emails I get every week is how big a percentage should the control premium be? And if you ask them where did that 20% come from, they all point to the same database. It's a database called Mergerstat, which includes every acquisition done in the U.S. And what they look at is the premium paid by acquirers for target companies over and above the market price. So roughly speaking, historically in the U.S., people have paid a 20% premium on the market price. So let's separate the fact from the rule. The fact is that premium is being paid, 20%. Let's take that as a fact. Can I call that a control premium? Let's step back. Why do acquirers pay premiums for target companies? Let's go through the reasons. It could be for control. What else could it be for? It could be for synergy. What else? How about stupidity? If you overpay for a company, where is it going to show up? It's going to show up in the premium. It could be control, it could be synergy, it could be stupidity, it could be ego, it could be any number of different things. So I observe a premium, but I have no idea what that premium is for. If I attach that premium on as a control premium, I have no idea what that 20% is for. So let's step back. Let's think about the value of control. The value of control comes from the fact that you think you can run the target company. I showed you what the numbers look like for the target company. That you think you can run the target company better than I'm running the company. I'm running the target company. Right now, I have a 20% pre-tax margin and a 12% after-tax margin. Let's say that you think you can come into this company and cut costs. You can run it more efficiently. And by doing so, you're able to increase my margin from 20 to 30%. What's the value of control now? The value of the company used to be $60 million with me running it. With you running it, the value of the company is going to become $90 million because the profits are going to jump from $12 to $18 million. You have a control premium, but it's not 20%. It's 50%. Why? Because I'm running the company badly. And in fact, if you have a target company that's perfectly managed and perfectly run already, the control premium should be zero. Don't fall for that 20% across the board because it will vary across companies. Yeah. No, they don't. They don't. And let me take that back. We don't know. Right? That's actually a good question. The question was, do they already include some of this in the DCF already? Do you see why this matters? When I value the target company, if I put in a 30% margin already, saying I'm going to run the company, I'm going to cut costs, and then I add a 20% premium on top of that, I'm doing triple damage to myself, right? Because I've already built into my DCF whatever I think I'm going to do with control. I'm adding a 20% premium on top of the $90 million. That takes me $108 million. Not only have I overpaid, But I've also left all of the value created by control on the table for the target company stockholders. You're doing the hard work of cutting costs, and guess who's collecting the upside? The target company stockholders are. So if you're going to talk about the value of control, let's do this right. Because the value of control is just a rule of thumb. As it's applied now, 20%, 25%, 30%. If we want to value control, we have to think about valuing the company twice. We're going to come back and talk about this on Wednesday. But if you think about the DCFs you've turned into me, it's a value for the company, right? On Wednesday, I'm going to talk about a status quo value and an optimal value, which actually goes to your question of, hey, what have I already built into my DCF? The status quo value is with the existing management running the company. So remember all those questions you confronted when you did your valuation? Well, the debt ratio is low. Should I increase it? They're taking bad projects. Should I change it? If the status quo is they don't borrow money and they take bad projects, guess what? Your valuation should reflect it. In your optimal value, I'm going to let you take the lid off the company. And you can run the company. You can change the debt ratio. You can change their investment and financing policy. You can end up with a very different value for the company. So one of the problems with all these rules of thumb is they're on top of a DCF, and as you pointed out, we have no idea what's already built into the DCF. So any questions on the value of control? Okay. So control premiums can be 0%, it can be 50%, they can be 500%, depending on how badly a company is run. So let's talk about synergy. I think in 90, 95% of all mergers, this word comes up somewhere. Why are you doing a merger? Because there's synergy. Can somebody give me a good working definition of synergy? And don't tell me 1 plus 1 is 3. Please don't even say that. Not only is it absurd, it's mathematically incorrect. It's a terrible way to think about synergy. So give me a way that I can identify synergy. What's a good definition of synergy? Come on, you can try. You know enough valuation now. Anna, you want to try? Good.
The joint value created from two companies together that they wouldn't be able to separately.
In fact, it's something that two entities, it doesn't even have to be two companies, right? Two entities coming together are able to do something that they could not have done as individual entities. That's the key. Could not have done as individual entities. The next time, you read in the Wall Street Journal about, you know, some manager will talk about synergy. And he'll say, the synergy in this acquisition is going to come from the fact that we're going to run the factories of the target company more efficiently. We're going to cut costs of the target company factories. Why is that not synergy? Because they could do it themselves. There's nothing you're bringing to the table. That's control. A lot of times when people talk about synergy, it seems that they have no idea what synergy is. I had dinner with a friend of mine whose company got acquired last week for a lot of money. He's going to be very rich in a few weeks. But I asked him, what is it that made your company attractive? And he started listing off reasons. In my mind, I stayed polite. I didn't say anything. But as he listed off the reasons, that's not synergy. So here's the first thing he said. We have almost no geographic overlap. Okay, that's good. So you're not competing against each other. So you have no reverse synergy. That's good. But why is not having... There's a way in which you can create synergy, right? If you have no geographic overlap and you tell me, look, I can bring my products into their geographies and their products into mine. That's synergy. But just because you're in different geographies doesn't create synergy. He said, our earnings per share are going to be accretive. I'm going to come back and deal with that in a moment. That's kind of, I can't think of a good reason, so I'll throw this onto the table. But almost everything he listed, I looked at and said, you don't need to do a merger to do that. So the essence of synergy is you're combined as a company, you can do things you could not have done as individual company. So let me ask you a kind of abstract question. Can synergy exist? Sure, right? It can come from cutting costs. It can come from higher growth. And if you're motivating a merger with synergy as your primary rationale, what do you have to do before you pay for the synergy? You have to put a number on it. You have to value it. The reason I say that's obvious, it's amazing how often you see people pay for synergy but never try to value it. They'll wave their hands and there's a lot of synergy, but it's too fuzzy, too subjective. I can't value it. So let's say you do value synergy and you come up with $150 million as the value of synergy, or $50 million. In this case, the target company was worth only $60 million, so let's make the synergy $50 million. Should you pay that $50 million as a premium. If you do, Anna, what happens? If you pay the entire synergy as a premium as the acquiring company, what's happened? Or even, let's say on an expected basis, the value comes is $50 million. You have a fair valuation. So let's take that off the table. You're right. You are taking the risk that the $50 million could be wrong. But let's say that's not even the issue. Let's say the $50 million is a fair value. Fernando? In other words, you pay for the entire $50 million. Who gets the $50 million? The target. Notice how this is a pattern over and over again. You do the work. I collect the benefits. No wonder it's so much fun being a target company shareholder. You fix the cost, I get the upside. You create synergies, I get the upside. If this were a fair world, what should you do? If synergy requires both companies to come together, what should you be demanding for if this were actually synergy created by both companies? You should be demanding for your share, right? Because you brought something to the table. It's not like I'm the only one creating the value here. I needed both companies to come together, and if both companies need to come together, you should be getting a share of that as well. You know why it doesn't happen? Because you're so eager to get the deal done that you start offering higher and higher premiums, and you push it all the way to the synergy and beyond. Let's not go to the beyond. But even if you paid the entire synergy, you've essentially walked away with a fair value. You've done a zero net present value project, and look at how much work you had to put in to get that zero net present value. So let's do some synergy valuation, because if any of you go to work in M&A, you will see this word come on. So I'm going to give you a framework for valuing synergy. So when you look at a merger and there's synergy, synergy can take one of two forms, broadly. It can be operating synergy or financial synergy. Let me explain what operating synergy is. Operating synergy shows up in the operations of the company, the cash flows and the growth, right? And if you look at operating synergies, here are the potential ways it can show up. The simplest operating synergy is economies of scale. What kind of mergers are you most likely to see that operating synergy in? Mergers of companies usually in the same business because you have overlap, right? In fact, towards the end of today's class, I'm going to talk about InBev buying SAB Miller. You know what business both are in, right? InBev is the largest brewer in the world. SAB Miller is the second largest brewer. And there was talk about economies of scale. Two companies in the same business come together, economies of scale. The reason that's an easy synergy to value is, what does it mean when you say economies of scale? That after you combine the companies, the combined costs are going to be lower than they were for the individual companies. The margin of the combined company is going to be higher than the weighted margins of the individual companies. Easiest of the synergies to value, because it's going to show up in the cash flows and you're done. The more difficult synergy to value is growth synergies. And it can show up in one of three ways. By combining the two companies, you might be able to earn higher returns on capital on your new investments. Remember how that drives growth? But maybe by combining the two companies, you create a stronger competitive position. It increases your return on capital. Higher return on capital translates into higher growth. That will be the first way. The second is, by combining the two companies, you're now able to take more investments than you used to as individual companies. So Coca-Cola buys a beverage company in India. Maybe that beverage company in India wasn't taking much in investments, and Coca-Cola didn't have much investment opportunities in the U.S. But as a combined company, maybe they have more projects they can take, which could increase value. The third is, maybe by combining the two companies, you've made your competitive position stronger. You say, what does that mean? You earn excess returns for a longer period, which increases value. You see what I'm trying to do? I'm trying to take synergy and look for an input in my valuation that I can adjust. Is it a longer growth period, a higher return on capital, a higher reinvestment rate? Because then it shows up as a higher growth rate and a higher value. So operating synergies show up in the numerator. Let's talk about financial synergies. Let's start first with a synergy that should never be mentioned if it's a reason for a merger. You know what that is? Taxes. Never tell the world that you're doing a merger to save taxes. Why? That's like waving a red flag right in front of the tax guy saying, come and get me, and guess what? He's going to come and get you, or she's going to come and get you 100% of the time. But let's face it, a lot of mergers are motivated for tax reasons. And let's look at some of the ways in which tax benefits can show up as synergy. Maybe By combining the two firms, you're able to take the losses on one firm and claim it against profits in the other. So rather than carry losses forward, you get the tax savings right away. That's one potential. Here's the second potential one. If you can write up the assets of the target company after acquiring it, you know what I mean by write up? Take the book value of the assets and increase it to reflect the fact that you paid a higher price. Why is that good, to write up the book value? Because you get more depreciation. Depreciation saves you taxes. You could potentially save on taxes, increase your value. And there are quirks in the tax law around the world that companies exploit to sometimes create value from mergers. I'll give you a couple of examples. In Brazil, and I've talked a little bit about this earlier, there is this item called interest on capital you're allowed to claim as a tax deduction. It's actually unique to Brazil. And here's how it works. Every year, Brazilian companies are allowed to subtract out interest expenses for taxable income, just like every other company. But they're also allowed to take their book equity and multiply it by a rate that the Brazilian government supplies each year and come up with an additional deduction. So if you have a book value of equity of $1 billion, last year I think the Brazilian government said you could take 12% of that book value and claim it against your taxable income as a tax deduction. Why is the Brazilian government doing it? It's a ham-handed way of trying to reduce the tax benefit of debt, make it more easier for you to raise equity. But you see why this can play into acquisitions? What happens to the book value of a company right after an acquisition? You acquire that company, you pay this huge market value, right? It comes onto your company, and then your book value kind of inflates. With a higher book value, what's going to happen? 12% of a higher book value will give you an even bigger tax benefit. And if you think about that tax benefit over time, that could be a pretty substantial tax benefit. In fact, you know, when InBev used to be just a Brazilian beverage company, and InBev used to be a Belgian brewer, and InBev bought InBev about 10 years ago to start that empire going, it is estimated that almost 60% of the synergy in that merger came from this interest on capital item because it's a Brazilian company. That's a tax benefit. And as I said, if you have a tax benefit, don't be stupid enough to go up on the rooftops and yell, we're doing this for the tax benefits, we're doing it for the tax benefits. And that's what I did not understand a couple of years ago when Pfizer tried to buy Allergan. You remember that? Pfizer is a U.S. company. Allergan is an Irish company, I think. So what was it? Does anybody remember the rationale, Luis? Do you remember why Pfizer wanted to buy Allergan? Technically, what they were going to do was they were going to do the merger, and after the merger, the combined company, Pfizer was a much bigger company than Allergan, but they were going to do the merger, but the merged company was going to have its headquarters in Ireland rather than the U.S. You're saying, so what? But we talked about the quirks of the U.S. tax law. If you're a company that makes income outside the U.S., you have to pay the U.S. tax rate on it, and you have all this trapped cash as a consequence. The minute you become an Irish company, guess what happens? All those problems go away. Your trapped cash gets untrapped. You know, overnight, if Apple could become a Singapore company, $230 billion in cash would be released instantaneously. That's a big incentive. Do you know any Singapore companies that Apple can acquire and claim that we're now a Singapore company? No, but that's exactly what Pfizer tried. You could see what they were doing, but this is the part I did not understand. The CEO of Pfizer was on CNBC. And the CNBC reporter asked him, why are you doing this merger? I expect it. If you're the CEO of Pfizer, this is the real reason you're doing it, is to save tax. I ask you, why are you doing this merger? What should you be telling me? About the drugs in the... don't even talk about taxes. If I bring up taxes, I didn't even think about that. This is all because we see synergies and all. So talk about cost cuts and revenue growth and good drugs in the pipeline and how this is all going to play out. But here's what the CEO of Pfizer says. We're doing it to save taxes. The minute he said that, it became part of the presidential campaign. And who can blame every reporter? You're going to save taxes. That's why. And the minute that became the key narrative for why it was destined to doom. It did not happen because once that became the forefront, the U.S. Treasury actually wrote a tax rule specifically designed to stop the Pfizer-Allergan merger. Stupidity creates its own consequences. So if taxes are the reason you're doing a merger, Be quiet about it. Just do it. Give me 100 other reasons. And save taxes. I would say, oh my God, I never thought this would happen. We've saved a lot in taxes. Okay. The second potential financial synergy is if you have two companies that by themselves could not borrow money. Keyword is could not. So you do their optimal debt ratios. Their optimal debt ratios are 20% of standalone companies. They create a combined company. The combined company is now able to borrow 30%. How is that possible that two companies standing alone could not borrow more than 20%, but that the combined company is actually able to borrow 30%? How much a company can borrow depends on its default risk, right? So let's say you're a cyclical company. When you borrow money, you have to decide how much you can pay in a recession year, not just a recovery year. So based on that, you stop at 20%. Let's say I'm a counter-cyclical company. You know what a counter-cyclical company is? I move in the opposite direction. You acquire me. What happens to your company after the acquisition? You now have smoother earnings, but now, even though individually we could not borrow, now as a combined company, I'm able to borrow. You're saying, so what if I can borrow more money? Where does it show up in your valuation? Your debt ratio goes up, your cost of capital goes down, your value increases, and in effect, you've captured a tax benefit again in your valuation because you can borrow more money. Yes? It's a diversification argument. That's one of the few good diversification arguments, that if you can diversify and increase your debt capacity, but diversification just for the lower risk doesn't quite carry it through, right? It is, in fact, an extension, but to the extent that the diversification creates a debt capacity is why you're getting the additional value. Which brings me to my final argument. This is a pure diversification argument. You know the pure diversification argument, right? You have two risky companies, they come together. Mathematically, the combined company is going to be safer than the two risky companies. Why? Because, remember, it's a two-asset portfolio, right? As long as the covariance is less, or the correlation is less than one, combining two companies. So for a long time, this used to be the reasons for conglomerates. That I'm going to buy a chemical company, then I'm going to buy a financial services company, then I'm going to buy a bank. I mean, basically, their argument was, I'm getting diversified, that's good, right? What's wrong with that argument if you're a publicly traded company? Why, if I'm a publicly traded steel company, should I not go buy another oil company? No. Let's not even bring the CAPM. There's actually a much simpler way to, you're right, CAPM will not compensate you, but tell me why it's a bad idea. So because in a sense, they're saying, I'm going to get diversified for you. CAPM says be diversified. All I'm doing is I'm doing the diversification rather than have you. I'm saving a... So, but what's wrong with my doing this? I'm saving you some trouble. I'll do the diversification. All you need to do is then have just GE in your portfolio, and I will have 50 different companies. Why would you rather do the diversification than have me do it for you? Okay, that's the first problem. So that's actually good because you say, look, I want to buy a tech company because if I go pick a tech company for you, it might not have been the tech company you wanted to add. What else? How many times have you paid a 30% premium over the stock price when you went and bought? This has ever happened to you on an online brokerage service? Stocks trading at 10. Do you guys ever offer 13 or 14 for those shares? As an individual investor, you don't pay a premium to do your diversification, right? When I have to do the diversification for you, what do I have to do? I have to hire a banker. The banker finds a target company. Then to buy the target company, what do I have to do? I have to pay a 25, 30% premium. It makes absolutely no sense for a public company to go out and do diversification for you as an investor because it's much cheaper and much better for you to do it yourself. You're saying, then why did he even list it up there? It might make sense if you're a private business. Think of why. Remember when we talked about private businesses? What did we do to adjust the cost of equity? We took the market beta, you couldn't have forgotten already, and then we made the market beta into a total beta. Remember that? To get from market beta to total beta, what did we need? We needed a correlation of your company with the market. So we said if you're a private company, your cost of equity is going to be much higher than for a public company because you face this penalty. Now do you see for a private company why diversification might be a way of reducing the impact? As you diversify as a private company into more and more businesses, what's going to happen to that correlation with the market? It's going to rise towards one. In fact, if I can create this huge private company that's in 50 different businesses, I've in effect created a diversified portfolio within my private company. That correlation is going to be close to one. My market beta and my total beta are going to converge. I'm not going to face a private company problem anymore. Take a look at any old family group of companies anywhere in Asia or Latin America. Take the Tata Group in India. What businesses is the Tata Group in? There are 116 Tata companies. They're in every conceivable business. And it's not just the Tata Group. You take any family group anywhere in Asia, you'll find that they have their tentacles in pretty much every business. That's a survival mechanism. The reason they did that is it allowed them to be diversified before there were public markets. That rationale might have gone away, but you can see why they did what they did. So that kind of summarizes all of the different factors. Let's talk about the process by which you would value synergy. So I come to you with an M&A deal. It's a value synergy in this deal. Here are the three steps you need to go through. First, value the acquiring company and the target company as standalone entities. Forget about the merger. Value them as standalone entities. So just do a DCF of the acquiring company, DCF of the target company. If there were no synergy in this deal, what should the value of the combined company be? Just the sum of those two values. Values are additive. So that's step two. Then in step three, take the combined company and go crazy with it. Put in every conceivable synergy you can think of. Cost cutting, higher growth. Value the combined company with all the synergy benefits built in. And if you were right about synergy existing, the value that you get for the combined company in step three will be much greater than the values that you got for the two independent companies. The difference in value between what you get in step three and what you got in step two is the value of synergy. It's as simple as that. So let's try this. Okay? It's from about a decade ago, more than that now, when Procter & Gamble bought Gillette, one of the biggest M&A deals of all time. Procter & Gamble at that time was the largest consumer product company in the world. Gillette was the sixth largest consumer product company in the world. So I decided to, and there was lots of talk of synergy in the air. That's why they said the acquisition was being driven by synergy. So I decided I wanted to value synergy, and I wanted to do a best case valuation of synergy. In a moment, you're going to see why it's a best case valuation of synergy. So here's the first thing I did. I took Procter & Gamble and Gillette as standalone companies and valued them as standalone companies. As standalone companies, Procter & Gamble, I valued at $221 billion. Gillette, I valued at about $60 billion. So let me pause right there. I have a $221 billion value for Procter & Gamble, $60 billion for Gillette. If there is no synergy in this deal, the combined company's value should be about $281 billion. So I decided to combine the two companies. I call it Piglet, but that's not the name they picked. Well, Procter & Gamble, Gillette, I think they should have gone with Piglet, but they stayed with Procter & Gamble. So if there are no synergy, the value of the combined companies is the sum of the two. But here's where the best case scenario kicked in. At the time of the merger, Procter & Gamble managers had a laundry list of things that they said they were going to do after this merger. They said they were going to cut costs by $250 million. They talked about cutting the advertising because both companies are huge advertisers. They said we can cut costs by $250 million. I assume they meant what they said and that it would happen instantaneously. You see why this is the best case scenario? Even if you cut costs, it almost never happens overnight. But let's say you mean what you say and you cut costs immediately. I cut the expenses by $250 million. What that does is it improves their operating income by $250 million and flows all the way down. The second thing they talked about was how, as a combined company, they were going to be able to grow a little faster than they were able to grow as individual companies. They were very fuzzy about what they meant by faster. But I said, you know what? Maybe you're right. Maybe you'll grow about 1% more than you used to. You say, only 1%? Remember, these are two really large companies. 1% is a huge jump in your growth rate on a compounded basis. So I cut costs by $250 million. I gave them a higher growth rate. I revalued the combined company with those changes put in, and the value that I got for the combined company was $298 billion. You see what the value of synergy is? The value of the companies with no synergy is $281 billion. The value of the company with the synergies put in, the best case, is $298 billion. The difference between those two is my best case valuation of synergy, and it's about $17.2 billion. There's this canard about finance that we don't think Synergy is worth money. I mean, I've just given you a pretty hefty value, $17.2 billion. But here's the bad news. You know what premium Procter & Gamble actually paid for Gillette? They paid $25 billion. Now do you see what the problem in acquisitions is? It's not that there isn't synergy, but if you paid that plus 20% more, how the heck are you going to walk away with value from this deal? In fact, I would argue that the $17 billion is probably too high, and here's why. When you combine two really big companies, it takes a while to work through the kinks, right? Let's say it's going to take you 2 years to cut costs. It's not going to happen overnight. What's the value of synergy if it's going to take 2 years to cut costs? What would I need to do? Discount the $17 billion by 2 years at the cost of capital. Let's get this specific. At what cost of capital? The combined company's cost of capital, because the $17 billion. So if I discount the $17 billion, the combined company's cost of equity or capital, what I get as a present value will be, instead of $17 billion, will drop to $14 billion or $14.5 billion. And if you're paying $25 billion for this, this is not going to be a good deal for you. So the next big M&A deal that you read about in the newspaper, put it under the microscope. You don't have to do a full-fledged valuation, but start thinking about, hey, what are they talking about? Where would I shorten a valuation? And after a while, it's going to become second nature. If you do that enough, then you will never read an acquisition story as just a story. It'll become a way for you to think about, how does it play out in valuation? And are these guys even talking about something that makes sense? So let's take another example of synergy. Okay? Let's assume that you're Best Buy. And this was when Best Buy was actually a healthy retailer. It no longer is. So let's say you're Best Buy. You're a healthy retailer. You're buying Zenith. There's a time when Zenith actually made TVs and made electronics. You know what Zenith's biggest asset now is? A big NOL. They've lost enough money. So let's keep this. It's a shell company with a big net operating loss. The net operating loss is about $2 billion. So you guys be Zenith. You be Best Buy. You're buying Zenith not for the brand name. There's no brand name here. Not for the products, but just for the NOL. I want you to tell me, assuming you can use this NOL in your to protect your taxes, what the value of this NOL is if your tax rate is 36%. So you're the acquiring company. You're going to acquire the company, get the NOL. If you can claim the NOL against your profits right away, that's going to save you about 36% of $2 billion, which is $720 million. So your tax benefits, if you can claim the NOLs instantaneously, is about $720 million. But let's make this interesting. Let's assume you don't have $2 billion in taxable income. Because remember, to claim the NOL, you need $2 billion in taxable income. Let's assume you have only $500 million in taxable income and you expect to make $500 million every year for the next 4 years. Now what's the value of the NOL? It'll be $180 million every year for the next 4 years. And now comes the interesting question. This is actually one of the most fascinating questions in valuation. What discount rate should you use to discount the $180 million in tax benefits back to today? Let me give you the choices. I could discount back at the risk-free rate. If I do that, what am I saying about these tax benefits? They're guaranteed, right? I could discount them back at the cost of debt, in which case I'm saying the only risk of me not getting these NOLs is if I go bankrupt. I could discount back at the cost of capital, or I could discount back at the cost of equity. This would be a good final exam question, but I'm going to throw it out right now. Which of these four discount rates should I use to discount the $180 million every year for the next 4 years? I'll give you a clue. Think about what you're most uncertain about. What's the basic, where's the risk coming from here that you will not get the NOL? And that's going to tell you what discount rate to use. Is the NOL no? We know what the NOL is, so there's no risk in the NOL. What is it being set off against that you're uncertain about? Your taxable income. You're uncertain about what your taxable income is. I've kind of given enough clues. Taxable income, what's the right? So it's clearly not the risk-free rate. Your taxable income is not guaranteed. It's not the cost of debt. It's not the default risk in the taxable income. Is it the cost of capital or the cost of equity? It's taxable income, not operating income. What's taxable income? It's income after interest expenses, which makes it a cost of equity. It's really an equity income, the right discount rate to apply to take the present value of the $180 million back to today is the cost of equity. Remember that, because this is a debate you're going to have about 6 or 9 months from now. When you're on the desk and somebody says, we have NOLs, we want to compute the value of the NOLs, what discount rate should we use? It should be the cost of equity, but be ready to justify why it should be the cost of equity, because the number that drives whether you get it or not is the uncertainty about the taxable income, and that uncertainty about the taxable income feeds into a cost of equity. So don't pay for buzzwords. Synergy is good, but you have to value it. If you're going to pay for it, you have no choice but to value the synergy. Any questions about synergy? So at this stage, I'm ready to give up on you because everything I throw at you, you stop me. So first I said, why don't you pay a higher price? You have a lower cost of equity, and you brush me off. I said, I can't use a lower cost of equity because the target company's cost of equity is high. Then I said, you have lots of access to cheap debt. Why don't you use that? And you said, no, you can't do that because it's not something the target company's talk over. I tried to make you pay a 20% premium for control, but you said, no, I don't pay premiums for control. Then I tried to use synergy, but I couldn't name anything substantial as synergy. I'm kind of desperate. So I said, you know what? I should have never gone down this DCF path. I said, this is a pricing game. Let's price the company. And here's my justification. I tell you that other acquirers are paying 5 times EBIT to buy companies in this sector. And I point to other acquisitions. It's called transaction multiples. Basically, 10 other transactions that have been done, acquisitions, 5 times EBIT. Remember, your EBIT was 20 million? 5 times 20 million is 100 million. Okay? It's a pricing, right? Rather than evaluation, if you believe in a price. Most acquisitions get justified based on pricing. There's a DCF that's reverse engineered to justify the pricing, but it's 6 times EBITDA, 10 times earnings, 5 times EBIT. You're tempted, okay? But you're worried. That's a pricing. I said, don't worry about it. I'm going to do cash flows, and I'm going to put the pricing on my end number, not my starting number. Does that make you feel a little better about this? It's still a pricing, right? So to kind of make this acceptable to you, I hit you with that word that you hear in every acquisition that bankers use to justify the acquisition. I tell you that this acquisition is going to be accretive. What does that mean, accretive? What is an accretive? Accretive as opposed to what? Dilutive. You'll hear bankers use the word accretive in acquisitions till the cows come home. So when a banker says a deal is accretive, what does he mean? Or she mean? What does an accretive deal do? Want to try? It increases the earnings per share of your acquiring company. Now you see why that he hopes that if your earnings per share goes up, this is how he hopes the rest of your logic will kick in. Let's say you trade at 20 times earnings right now. Your earnings per share go up by 10%. What should happen to your price? It should increase by 10% because 20. So if you keep the P/E ratio fixed, accretive deals are good deals and dilutive deals are bad deals. It's one of the most dangerous words in finance. And let's think of what? When you think about first, and let's take the two parts of this process that I've done that should give you trouble. The first was I did a pricing, just like we talked about pricing. You're saying, what's wrong with this? You're just doing a pricing. But the sample that I used for my pricing was other acquisitions. You think, so what? Statistics. Remember we talked about bias samples? Is a sample of other acquisitions a bias sample? What do we say acquirers tend to do? They tend to overpay, right? If I take a sample of other deals where people are likely to overpay, and I base what I pay on what they pay, I'm almost guaranteed to overpay. So it's a biased bad sample. So if you're going to price things, at least do it honestly. Take the entire sector, run a regression, do whatever we did in full pricing. That is more justifiable than just picking up a transaction multiple sample. So that's the first problem. And here's the second one. You know how you can make an accretive deal? Anytime you buy a company with a lower price earnings ratio than yours, by definition, the deal is going to be accretive. Now do you see why accretive can't be a measure of a good acquisition? Because if that's true, what should I do to just increase value? I should just find every company. So if I'm trading at 25 times earnings, I should take every company that trades at 15, 12, 10 times earnings and just buy the company, and my earnings per share should go up. So what's the missing piece? There must be some logical piece that keeps this from becoming a value-creating device. So let's say that I'm a company that has a 25 times earnings. I'm trading at 25 times earnings. I find a target company that trades at 10 times earnings. I buy the target company. I told you, your earnings per share is going to be accreted. It's going to go up. Why is your price unlikely to go up? What's the question you need to ask? Why is the target company trading at 10 times earnings, right? Let's say the target company is really risky or has really low growth, both of which are possible. You buy the company, your earnings per share goes up. Complete the story for me. What else is going to happen? What do we say the P/E ratio is a function of? Your growth, your risk, and your return equity. You just bought a bad company with low growth rates and a terrible return equity and lots of risk. Your P/E ratio is not going to stay at 25 times earnings. It's going to drop. By how much? It depends on how much you overpaid for the company. It has nothing to do with whether your deal is accretive or dilutive. It goes back to what's the value of the target company and how much do you pay for it. But you see the bankers and analysts use the word accretive and dilutive in acquisitions as if it's the only thing they have to watch for to decide whether a deal is a good deal or a bad deal. So don't be a lemming. Just because everybody kind of uses words like accretive and dilutive, don't get sucked into it. Stop and be the skunk at the party and say, hey, you know what? What's this big deal about being accretive? Why should we be celebrating just because this is an accretive deal? So now at this stage, nothing I'm trying is working on you, right? I tried every single ploy. So I hit you with what I think is the ploy that's going to work. I say, you know what, guys? Your CEO, you're the acquiring company, you're the top manager, middle managers. Your CEO really wants to get this deal done. So you can throw all the roadblocks you want at me, but here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to your CEO and say, look, you know, your managers seem to not like this deal. And what's going to happen to you? Your CEO is going to call you in and say, what is it I hear about you throwing roadblocks on this deal? I want this deal to go through. It's stating a fact, but in most deals, the decision gets made at the top and it percolates its way. It's not like the janitor wakes up one morning and says, let's do a big deal. It's the CEO waking up from a dream saying, in my dream yesterday, I was the CEO of the largest company in the world, so let me go out and bigger, and the whole thing percolates through. It's, I think, one of the problems with acquisitions is the decision gets made first and the analysis follows. And once you decide to do a deal, the process kind of goes out of control, right? Because once you decide to do a deal, what happens? You hire bankers and you hire consultants. And these guys live off, or these people live off the deal. They want the deal to go through. So once you've invited the bankers and the consultants into this game, it's almost impossible for you to step away from the game. So the next time you want to do a big deal, if you're a CEO, if you get to that level, be careful about starting this process rolling, because once it starts rolling, it's almost impossible to stop this thing from catching more, from, you know, getting more speed. So I'll give you an example of how rationalization allows managers to get away with really bad deals. So about maybe 6-7 years ago, Hewlett-Packard, which has a history of doing terrible things to stockholders, decides to do an acquisition of a company called Autonomy. Autonomy is this UK-based, you know, software company. HP decides, and it gave all these stories about it. But I'm going to give you the rationalization they gave for why they chose to pay $11.1 billion for Autonomy that was at that time priced at $5.9 billion. They paid a $5.2 billion premium. First thing they did was they hired Deloitte to come in and revalue Autonomy. You know, they come in and they do fair value accounting. So Autonomy's book value of equity was about $2.1 billion. After Deloitte got through with the revaluation, they claimed that the book equity had jumped from $2.1 billion to $4.6 billion. The accountants had discovered $2.5 billion in uncovered book value. Then they went away. the market price was already $5.9 billion. So I don't even know why they bothered bringing in Deloitte to write up the book value, but I guess it made their goodwill a smaller number, if that's the incentive. So that $5.9 billion was the market value. They paid $11.1 billion. They justified the $11.1 billion by saying there's a lot of synergy in this deal. Trust us. So they do the deal. It's one of the few deals where everybody else in the world thought they'd paid too much. So in fact, Leo Apotheker, who was the CEO of Hewlett-Packard, was at an equity research conference in New York, and one of the analysts got up. And this is unusual for an analyst, but the analyst said, hey, how do you justify this deal? It looks like you guys paid too much. I'm going to read exactly what he said because I don't want to be accused of putting words in his mouth. Here's how Leo Apotheker, CEO of HP, explained to analysts why this was a good deal. He said, we have a pretty rigorous process inside HP that we follow for all our acquisitions, which is a D.C.F based model. This is when you put up and say, what's the D, what's the C, what's the F, right? D.C. So I left the dots where they were because that's what the story actually had. D.C. He said in reference to discounted cash, that's in case the Wall Street Journal reporter thought you wouldn't know what DCF was, he expanded others, discounted cash flow valuation, a standard valuation methodology, which is not the way I would describe it. And we tried to take a very conservative view. People were still skeptical. He said, no, no, wait, wait. Just to make sure everybody understands, autonomy will be on day one. What's the word that's being thrown into the mix? Accretive to HP. Just take it from us. We did the analysis at great length, in great detail, and we feel we paid a very fair price for autonomy and it'll give a great return to shareholders. This was in 2009. Now, usually you've got to wait a decade for these mistakes to unfold. 2 years later, HP admitted that they'd screwed up. By how much? They wrote down the $11 billion to $2.3 billion. An $8.8 billion. Now, this is going to be tough to explain away, right? And they claimed that the entire mistake was because autonomy had cooked its books. They blamed the accountants at autonomy. So I decided to apportion blame. I said, you made a mistake. This is a big mistake. It can't be just the accountant. Let's see who's responsible. So here's how I broke down the... I first started off by blaming HP's old CEO, that Leo Apotheker that I quoted, and HP's deal bankers. They were responsible for about $4.45 billion in non-existent synergy. So even if the accounting had been completely fair, there would be no synergy there. So I said they should. And what does that mean? I would collect back all the fees that I paid the bankers and make Leo Apotheker give back all of his... none of which really happened, but that's what I would do. I attached about $2.5 billion to autonomy's managers in Deloitte to the extent that they did kind of dress up the books. So I blamed autonomy's managers and their accountant. Okay. But then there was an additional $1.9 billion in value where the company continued to deteriorate while HP ran it. And for that, I blamed HP's new CEO, was Meg Whitman, and the new board of directors. $8.8 billion of mistakes, lots of different entities responsible. But here's the bottom line. Not one of them paid a dollar or paid a price for making a mistake of this magnitude. Meg Whitman stayed on as CEO. Leo Apotheker kept his old compensation. The bankers got paid the fees that they never returned. The accountants never got into trouble. Autonomy's managers walked away from the deal. This is a bad deal, a really bad deal. And it's a deal which unfolded soon enough that you should have been able to hold people responsible, but even on this deal, nobody paid a price. It's a Time Warner. Remember one of the worst deals in history when they bought AOL for $100 billion at the peak of the dot-com boom? Not one person was held responsible for that. And that, to me, is at the core of why I think acquisitions often fail and continue to fail. So at this stage, I've painted a very depressing view of acquisitions. Let's say you go to work for a company that says, we are going to grow through acquisitions. Part of you wants to throw up and leave, but then you lose your job. So I'm going to give you some hope to end this session. I'm going to talk about where acquisitions are most likely to pay. In fact, you can tell me, based on what we already know, where you think acquisitions are more likely to pay. And I'm going to give you choices. If you're an acquirer, would you like to be a sole bidder or in a bidding war? Sole bidder, right? How about, would you rather go after public targets or private targets? You see what I mean by public targets? Public targets are publicly traded companies that you're acquiring. Private targets are private companies. Would you rather go after public or private targets? Why? There's no free rider problem. In addition, to buy a public company, what do you have to do? Start with the market price and pay a premium. At least with a private company, the whole thing is negotiated. Would you rather pay with cash or pay with stock? This is a tough one. Because remember, you can pay with you can issue shares in your company, or do you pay with cash? You're saying it depends. It depends on what? Whether you think your stock is overpriced. You say, my stock is overpriced, I'll pay with stock. If it's not, the only problem is, this is like game theory, right? What you decide to do, I watch as the target company stockholder. So when you offer shares in your company, what am I reading into it? That you must think that your stock is overpriced. And what do I do in response? I push up a premium. So this is, we'll look at what the evidence suggests. Would you rather go after small targets or large targets? Mergers of equals or mergers of unequals? It's much better to go after small targets. And would you rather base your acquisitions on cost synergies or growth synergies? Yeah. And why? And easier to plan for and easier to hold people accountable. You're going to shut down 50 stores after you buy my company. You can identify the 50 stores and you can make sure a year later that they've been closed. Growth synergies, much more fuzzy. So let's see if this plays out. The first graph I'm going to show you looks at what happened to stock prices of companies involved in bidding wars. So these are two companies bidding for a target company. One, in a bidding war, obviously, there's a winner and there's a loser in the bidding war. One of these lines goes with the winner, one of these goes with the loser. So in a bidding war, you either win the bidding war or lose the bidding war. Which one do you think goes with the winner? The one at the bottom is what you get with the winner. You win a bidding war, you get that day of celebration, right? Wall Street Journal announces you're the winner of the bidding war, and afterwards it's all downhill from there. If your company, if you're investing in a company and it's in a bidding war, please pray and hope it fails. It's the best possible outcome for you. If you look at companies where you buy the companies, in fact, there's a couple of things I can answer this. If you look at, so basically what I've done is I've broken down target companies based on size relative to your company. So the way to read this is the blue are companies that are less than 6% of your size. So if you're a $100 million company, these are target companies that are less than 6 million. Less than 5%. 5 to 10%. So basically, it's broken down from smallest targets to biggest targets. And it also looks at whether you pay with cash, stock, a combination, and also, let's start with the all at the end. Small to large, the pattern is clear, right? Smallest targets, you're most likely to earn a premium. The larger the target, the more negative the returns. If you look at cash versus stock, you get a mixed message, right? If you pay with cash, it's actually better to pay with cash on big deals and better to pay with stock on small deals. The way I read this, if you look at cash, on big deals, you're more likely to make a premium with cash. You think, why is that? The game theory kicks in. If I'm doing a really big deal and offer to pay with shares, then I have to worry about other shares overpriced. Small deals, you might be able to get away with it. So you'd rather do small deals than big deals, and rather pay with cash for big deals and stock for small deals. And finally, if you look at public versus private companies, it's no contest. So basically, you take the blue versus the red. You'd much rather buy private businesses as opposed to public companies. But there's one strategy that's even better than buying private businesses. It's buying a subsidiary of a public company. Why is that so lucrative? When do public companies try to sell off subsidiaries? When you have new managers who come in, when they get desperate. Valiant wants to sell off Salix, right? Why might you get a great deal on it? Because they're desperate. Ford sold off Jaguar Land Rover for nothing to Tata Motors. Why? Because they were desperate. They wanted to get rid of it. So if you want to build an acquisition strategy, I can give you the basis for building that acquisition strategy. And in fact, the final graph, I look at growth versus cost synergies. And this is from a McKinsey study that looks at what portion of the promised benefits actually get delivered. A far higher percentage of the promised benefits get delivered when you have cost savings. So if you look at the percentage, then if you have growth synergies. growth synergies are much more diffuse, more difficult to get delivered. So if you wanted to map a strategy to grow through acquisitions, I'll map out what it is. Buy small private companies using cost savings as your money. The only problem is, as you get successful, what's going to happen to your company? It's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. At some point, you're going to find yourself tempted to go after bigger companies. Why? Otherwise, people don't even notice, right? You're a $100 million company buying small companies, cutting costs. People might not even notice. That's when you're going to be tempted. And that's at the core for why it's so difficult for companies to succeed with acquisitions is you get undisciplined. You start to reach beyond your... This is Cisco. Was an incredibly successful company in the 1990s, growing by buying small technology companies, converting their products, making money off it. But then it got so big that it had to go after larger and larger companies. Valeant was incredibly successful from 2009 through 2013 buying small pharmaceutical companies, taking their drugs and raising their prices. But then it bought Salix, and the next thing it blew up. So when you look at the strategies, that's what I want you to keep in mind. So your bottom line is, if you want to be a successful acquirer, you've got to be disciplined, and you've got to be focused on what you're going after. You have to have plans before you do the merger. You can't wait until after the merger and synergy. You have to hold people responsible for delivering those plans. Otherwise, it's never going to happen. And people have to lose their jobs when they make bad acquisition decisions. Somebody's got to be held accountable. And if you can pull that off, you can grow through acquisition. But you can see why it's so much more difficult to grow through acquisition than with traditional investments. So let me end today by talking a little bit about a really big deal. I'll send you a webcast that I did around the YouTube video, at least I did around the deal. So this was a deal where AB InBev, which is a Brazil-based company, it's really not even Brazil-based, it's a global beverage company. You know, largest beer company in the world with revenues of $46 billion, strongest in Latin America, primarily in Brazil and the U.S., and has a history of growing through acquisitions. It's run by a group called the 3G Group, which has a very good reputation of cutting costs, private equity. They were buying SAB Miller, which is incorporated in the UK. It's the second largest brewer in the world with revenues of $22 billion. Strongest in Africa and Latin America. Already you can see that these two companies operate in different geographies. Owns 58%. Owns 58% of MillerCoors, a joint venture with Molson Beer. And in this deal, basically, AB InBev was going to buy SAB Miller. And because these were the largest brewery buying the second largest, there were going to be antitrust problems around the world. They had to sell their stake in the MillerCoors. That was going to be required as part of the deal. And they also had to sell their Chinese portion of SAB Miller because otherwise they'd have had a 90% market share in China. So that's what kind of cost. The benefits, basically, you can see huge companies. Okay? Before the deal was announced, this is what the market values look like, 175 and 75. So the combined value of the two companies was $250 billion. After the deal was announced, the market value of the two companies was $283. So if you take those numbers as a given, the market thinks it's a pretty good deal, right? In terms of total synergy, how do you get the value of the synergy? Take the combined values of the two companies. The market thinks it's about $28 billion worth of synergy. So I did an acquisition valuation of this deal, and basically I took both companies. So this is a picture of a, and you can see 42% Latin America, 36% North America, and you can see the operating margin is 32%. I want you to remember that number. That is the highest operating margin of any brewer in the world. AB InBev is a machine in terms of delivering profits. In fact, they bought this Mexican company. I'm trying to think of what the name of that Mexican company was. Mexican brewer. And whose margins were 14%. Within 2 years, it improved the margins of that company to 27%. So they have a history of going in and cutting costs. If you look at SAB Miller, not a bad company, but its margins are 20%. So you have a 32% margin company buying a 20% margin company. They're both big companies. They're both profitable companies. So the challenge here is, can they create $29 billion of synergy in this merger? Because that's the premium that they paid on this deal. So I tried to value the synergy in this deal. What are the steps in valuing synergy? I have to value AB InBev and SAB Miller as standalone companies. I did standalone DCFs, and I'm going to first make sure that the motive is not undervaluation, that SAB Miller is somehow not mispriced by the market, because that would be in a great way to make money, right? Buy a cheap company. I wanted to make sure that SAB Miller was not badly managed and badly run, so you could fix that. So basically, I wanted to look at undervaluation, control, and synergy as potential reasons. So here's the first thing I did. I looked at the acquisition price. I constructed a status quo value, basically with the existing management running two companies. Then I restructured SAB Miller. You're saying, what does that mean? I said, even without AB InBev coming in, if they could cut costs and run the company more efficiently, what would they be worth? I came up with the value of control. And finally, I valued synergy so that I could answer all three questions. So here's the first step. Value of SAB Miller status quo was about $51.5 billion. It was a little messy because I'd value SAB Miller, but remember that joint venture they have with Molson Coors? I valued that separately because it's a separate business. The total value for the company with the status quo is $51.5 billion. The market price was $75 billion, so it's not an underpriced stock, so it takes the easy way of making money off the table. Then I took AB InBev and I compared it to SAB Miller, and you can see basically that SAB Miller is about as efficient as the typical beverage company. It's just not as efficient as AB InBev. So that really becomes the core of the issue. Can AB InBev cut costs enough at SAB Miller to justify this huge premium being paid? So here's the last thing I did. I took the status quo value of SAB Miller. I construct an optimal value, which basically means if SAB Miller were run as efficiently as the more efficient beverage companies, that adds about $4.7 billion, but nowhere near the $29 billion that I need to justify this deal. So value control here is about $5 billion, because there are things I can fix at SAB Miller. It's optimal debt ratio. So this is basically changing from existing management to optimal management. Last step in the process, I decided to value the synergy. So there's InBev, there's SAB Miller, there's a combined firm, and the synergy basically shows up in the last column. And you can see that the red numbers are where I see the potential synergies. One was, I think they can improve their margins slightly. I don't think you can't make SAB Miller have the margins that AB InBev has, but you can move it towards it. You can increase the return on capital slightly. You can increase the everything has to be slightly. When you're the largest company buying the second largest company, nothing is going to change dramatically. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to value the combined company with those numbers, and I'm going to value the combined company with the synergy-driven numbers. And that difference that I get for the value of synergy is about $14.6 billion. So what's the bottom line? Even if you take the synergy and value, the value that I'm getting is $14.6 billion. If you're paying a $29 billion premium, there's something I'm not seeing. I don't know the beverage business enough, the brewery business enough to tell you that I feel. But the amount of value, the amount of income you've got to create a $29 billion premium seems to me out of the reach of this deal. And the reason I took so much effort to get there is because 3G was doing the deal. I bent over backwards saying, I must be missing something. But as far as I could see, they just overpay. Even smart people can overpay on deals. That's about it. When we start on Wednesday, we will do the last chunk of valuation, which is how to change the
Target a private company rather than a public company, but if for a private company, won't there be like less information available, and won't that make it a bit more?
No, it's a friendly, it's not a hostile acquisition, it's a friendly acquisition. The guy wants to sell you the company. But why would you hold back information?
Mm-hmm. But like, what about the accuracy of the information?
Nothing, those are all issues when you do a traditional acquisition. Yeah. Right? So you have to ask them for it.
When you say that you have to give like either sell or buy the recommendation, sell, what do you mean by sell? Like short sell? Or like don't touch it?
Of course, that's what it means. It's a short sell, but if I already own it, because remember, you're giving the recommendation to me as an investor. If I own Salesforce already, I'll sell it. If I don't own Salesforce, you're asking me to sell short, long.
What if I don't think, like, if you own it, you might want to sell it, but if you don't own it, like, don't short sell.
Then do a hold.
Okay.
Why do you not want to short sell?
I don't think it's going to go down, like, fast enough, and you're just going to, like,
okay,
lose money.
So
do
you think that's irrational for the hold?
Okay.
Because I have a question. Like, I'm evaluating Nielsen, and it's trading at 40, the stock price 40, but, like, my valuation is $8. I checked everything and just don't know what kind of like input might I might have put.
What's your current? I can't even read the number.